In June 2011, 54 American and international visitandines came together in St. Louis, Missouri, to celebrate the 400th anniversary of the Order of the Visitation of Holy Mary. The following talk is Our Five Foundation Stones by a Visitation Sister from Walden, Great Britain. For more information about the Order of the Visitation of Holy Mary, go to visitationspirit.org.
Well, I too would like to say good morning to everybody and to say what a privilege and a joy it is to be in the U.S. and what a joy it is to be in St. Louis, that gave to the world T.S. Eliot with his beautiful crafting of language. It's been so formative in so many of our lives. So it's a great joy for the Brits to be here. So following from our procession last evening, perhaps we could just quieten ourselves and ask God to make our hearts ready, receptive, and open to receive from him in this place, at this time, all that he wants to give us as we journey forward. Our Lady of the Visitation,
pray for us.
Okay, if you can't hear me, say. Well, as I look around, it's so fitting to say that we were founded on friendship. The Visitation is the mystery of friendship that is called to serve. Our bond. As I've read through the lives of the First Mothers, this sense of mutuality is very evident among them. They were all together in Annecy until 1615, when they went to Lyon, and from then on went to the burgeoning foundations all over France. But they kept the bond alive by letters that were often difficult to send in those days, and they supported, encouraged one another through the letters, which is what we're doing this week. We are supporting and encouraging one another as we journey. In Mother de Chargy's letter from Annecy, dated 1653, just before her deposition, she speaks of the annual visitation of Charles Augustus Sales, who was Holy Founder's nephew and successor. And she says that he wanted the sisters to celebrate with devotion the anniversaries of our First Mothers by receiving Holy Communion, which wasn't a daily communion in those days, by reciting the litanies which she herself had composed, and by reading their lives in the refectory. What's particularly interesting is his comment, and I quote. He says, "Your blessed mother, Jeanne de Chantal, mothers Favre, de Bréchard, de Châtel, and de Blony and de la Roche, ought to be your eternal models, and their memory held in everlasting blessing among you. They were on earth the foundation stones of your institute. If you are devoted to them, they will take care of you." The order of names is interesting. Mother de Chargy lists our First Mothers like that, and he signals out these five as the foundation stone, singular, of the Institute. So for the purpose we have, for the time we have together this morning, perhaps I could just reflect a little on these five women, talk about them historically, and hopefully give an insight into their personality and character. You know, we know this, we say it so often. There can be no true understanding of the present without knowledge of the past, so that we can wisely prepare for the future. So, we'll see. So, the that's Alice, of course, at the gallery. So, to marry Jacqueline Favre. Mother Duchaux, she says, she shone as the morning star that accompanies the dawn. How beautiful. She shone as the morning star that accompanies the dawn. She was born in Savoy. Now, France, Savoy was the duchy that was contingent on France, Switzerland, and Italy. She was born there, not part of France as such. She was of a bourgeois family, and her father was the president of the Senate in Chambéry, the then capital of Savoy. He was a great friend of Holy Founder, and was Holy Founder was his spiritual director. Her home background was ardently Catholic and devotional. We're told she had a beautiful nature and was gifted with the social graces of the time. The social graces were often singing and dancing, which defined your class. If Holy Mother could be described as sanguine, I think Marie Jacqueline may have been of a melancholic temperament. In her earlier years, we hear in dramatic terms of her terrible weariness of life, her languor, her anguish of spirit, of her tender and gentle nature. This is not to say she was sad and sorrowful. It's simply to describe her in terms of, you know, the four ancient definition of temperament that was prevalent in that day and indeed can still be found in personality profiling today. She experienced conflict in her life choice. She had offers of marriage, but decision-making did not come easily to her. She wanted above all things to be free. She considered marriage and religious life, but felt they held constraints too burdensome. She said, "I loved my liberty too well to think of entering the cloister, and that the state of marriage must be an insufferable burden. I thought the only happy people in this world were
widows.
Well done." Being very reflective, she began what we would call today a discernment of spirits to help her determine her path. Her life was very charmed, and she was the object of much flattery. And maybe to counterbalance that, and she was dramatic, remember? She began visiting the sick beds of the young and beautiful in Chambéry, and came face to face with death and diminishment. We can probably date her decision to embrace religious life from a ball in Chambéry around about 1608. In the midst of all the gaiety, she touched upon her own emptiness, and from this flowed the clarity and decision to become a religious. I put up this slide because it's the only slide I had of Chambéry, and it's of great interest to us. It's when Holy Founder was preaching to the Senate in Chambéry, and the rays from the crucifix enveloped him. And that crucifix is now in our monastery of Marclare that some sisters saw 2 years ago.
Oh, yes.
It's in the chapel in Marclare, but it's of great significance for us. It's the only slide I could find of Chambéry. Her imagination was lively and expansive, but living in the present didn't seem to be a natural disposition. So, just after profession, Holy Founder gave her a défi, a challenge. to live in the presence of God. Not to be futuring or looking back on the past, to live in the presence of God. Then she herself made a vow never to dwell on any thought not of God. And Mère de Chergy tells us that this seemed to be a very formative decision for her, and one from which the rest of her life flowed, to live in the presence of God. This is the virtue that's ascribed, the virtue ascribed to her is recollection, which has the import of the presence of God. I don't know whether you have it in your monasteries, but we've readopted it latterly, that on the eve of the anniversary of our first mothers, we say it's, so the 13th of June, we'd say it's Mother Fahd's anniversary tomorrow and her virtue is recollection. Do you have that in your monasteries?
No.
No. It just reminds us and keeps the memory present to us. Carl Jung wisely observed that the afternoon of life cannot be lived by the morning's rhythm. We're all experiencing that now, I suppose. The sensitive, maybe hypersensitive woman that Mother Favre seemed to be emerged from the morning of life with attitudes shaped and honed by prayer and experiences brought to prayer. She'd gone to Holy Mother to Lyon, our first monastery in France, with all its attendant difficulties, Cardinal de Marcamont, etc. She founded other monasteries from there. She exercised leadership for 21 years, and during these years, her personality and temperament came to be better poised. She had thought in her early years that the constraints of religious life would be too burdensome. As superior, she was always mindful of liberty and fidelity to the rules of the Institute. This holy liberty of spirit she gave to her daughters, keeping minds under too great restraint would spoil their devotion, and that she did not expect an equal perfection from all. I think that's so important in community. She did not expect an equal perfection from all. She who valued independence and loved to be free found liberty within the discipline of her vocation and led others to find it. There's a striking example of her composure and the equilibrium that she found. She was very close to her father, and when he died, she was devastated. In former days, she would have capitulated under the sorrow. She didn't. She resolved to celebrate his life rather than drown under the sorrow, and to remember the good things of his life. In other words, she didn't wallow in it. And that for her was a moment of conversion. She turned on that moment. Those of you who have experienced the death of a parent can identify with that. But for Mother Favre, who tended to sink, to spiral down into sadness, for me, she turned on that moment of conversion. And rather than, as I say, wallow in it, she found an equilibrium and composure. Mère de Chergy says, she wept her father's death as a daughter and consoled herself as a Christian for his loss. Holy found a cord, that's an example of her writing. I just like that sort of thing, so I put it on. Holy found a called her La Grande Fille, the eldest daughter of the Institute. I discovered this just a couple of weeks ago. Holy Mother wrote the obituaries of the first sisters who predeceased her. And in the obituary of Jacqueline Favre, Holy Mother particularly comments on her cordiality and her deference. And I think in our world we can be often so violent, how we approach one another is so important. We know we approach each other as gift or threat. Apparently Jacqueline Favre always used the verb prier, je vous prie. When she addressed somebody to ask, she approached with great deference and cordiality. I might say, would you, she said, something like in English, I suppose, may I ask you to. She was very deferential, very sensitive, very reverential, yes. Again, Mère Shoji says, she was a vessel of grace to receive and a channel to diffuse. She died in Chambéry, which moved to Saint-Père d'Albany, which closed recently with and fused with Marquenard. She was 46 when she died. Oh, lost my pitch. Okay. Well, this is Jeanne-Charlotte de Bréchard, with whom I had great difficulty. There is lots of writing, and Mère Shoji was a source, but it's Baroque writing, where everyone has to fit into a type, and that's the last thing I wanted to do, was to fit people into a type. Her writing was very Baroque, very elaborate. I have great difficulty with this anyway. So, Jacqueline was from Savoy. Mother Charlotte de Bréchard was from France, and France didn't look like that in 1610, but that's the present departments. I just wanted to show you, in relation to Annecy, where she was born in Burgundy. Her childhood was very different to that of Marie Jacqueline. She was the youngest of 10, and her mother died when she was about 8 months old. Mère de Shoji says the loss was irreparable and the root of all her suffering and anguish and destitution. Her father didn't care for her at all, and indeed when the plague broke out, he fled the castle and left her to the care of servants who were very unkind to her. In the litany composed in her honour, Mother de Shoji speaks of, for instance, you who bore the yoke of the Lord from your earliest infancy, you who were brought up, raised, and nourished by humiliation and suffering. So these young and formative years were dismal, dismal for her. She was lonely, abandoned, and unloved, but found refuge in the beauty, that's her chateau, in the beauty of the countryside, and in nature. That's the font that she was baptized in the church nearby, and the little inscription above just says she was baptized in this font and died in Rion in 1637. At 12, she went off to a Benedictine monastery that was unreformed. So the education was fine, but not befitting someone of her class. She was of the noblesse of Burgundy, a very prestigious family. It wasn't until she came into contact, her writing again, I have a penchant for such things, so I put it in. It wasn't until she came into contact, I'm out of sync. That should be Madame de Chantal. That's funny. No. Doesn't matter. It wasn't until she came into contact with Madame de Chantal, both Burgundian, that I really think Charlotte de Bréchard experienced affection. She hadn't had it from home, but she went to Burgundy because she was preparing to enter the Carmelites. Madame de Chantal kind of adopted her and prepared her to enter. I think for the first time, she sensed any maternal affection, any friendship. She did enter the Carmelites in Lent. They said they'd give her a trial period. She didn't have robust health, and it didn't work. So she left Madame de Chantal took her back to Bourbillon and looked after her there. Her home life and the years at school had been suffering ones. She had borne much and continued all through life to demand much of herself. And if you read her life, you get the sense of being really hard on herself. She tended to engage in great fasts and penances and have this great sense of responsibility. None of these traits left her, but they were tempered and transformed. She was essentially a pragmatic woman, and we don't identify great imaginings and dreams with her, but in fact it was two dreams that helped her to determine her vocation. The first dream, she was naked and felt ashamed. Someone clothed her in a scarlet robe. She ascended a staircase and found a religious sitting there who sounded a hunter's horn and said, "Will you be of my party?" and gave her a sprig of flowers. And Charlotte answered, "Yes, indeed, with all my heart." She saw that as a call to come. In the second dream, she saw a church with a cross and attempted to embrace the cross, and a voice said, "No, this is not for you. Go up higher." And she saw another cross befitting her. And 28 years later, she said, she recalled that dream as though it was yesterday, and said, quoting, "This new cross was our dear and most sweet institute, that without the heavy burden of great austerities, fails not to arrive at the height of perfection, of divine love." It was while staying, I've lost Holy Mother somewhere, I had a picture of Holy Mother. It was while staying with Holy Mother, while recouping her health after Carmel, that Holy found her visited, and she was thinking then of trying the Benedictines. And he spoke to her at great length, and he said, "Will you not run the race with Madame de Chantal?" Often you have to be direct. And she said, "Yes, I will, with all my heart," again. And she entered the gallery house, as we know, on the 6th of June, 1610. So in Annecy in 1611, Holy Mother went off to Burgundy to sort out her family affairs, and Holy Founder was in the Chablais. Charlotte de Breschard was left in charge as assistant, and all the sisters became ill. You all know this story, I'm sure. And she worked day and night, serving them, taking care of them, wearing herself out. This is her character, her personality. Holy Founder heard of it, and he said, "My very dear daughter, you must take sufficient repose and food, and lovingly leave some labor to others, not wanting to gain all the crowns. Your neighbor will be very glad to have some of them." The ardor of holy love, which urges you to wish to do everything, ought also to keep you back and allow others to do something. I desire to see you laboring with a spirit ardent but gentle, fervent but moderate. She had to be moderated right through her life. And who better to help her than Holy Founder? She was sent to the monastery of Moulins in 1616. And this foundation was beset with great difficulties and was probably one of the most painful in our history. As she set off, Holy Founder gave her a letter, arming her for the conflict ahead. The conflict is well annotated, is written well about. So he gave her this letter to support her, to encourage her, to give her hope. And I'll just mention one little bit of it. He urges her not to yield to discouragement, saying that distrust of self is good so long as it serves as a basis for trusting God. The impression one gets from reading the letter is that she was very reluctant to accept a role of leadership. Who isn't? He goes on to say, "My dear daughter, humility refuses offices, but is not obstinate in its refusal. And the humble soul, when employed by those in authority, no longer makes reflections upon its unworthiness, but with charity believes all things, hopes all things, bears all things." Now, this thing about writing, the mothers writing to each other. So, when it got too much for her, she wrote to Mother de Chateau, Père and Marie de Chateau at Grenoble. And she pours out her heart, as maybe we do sometimes to each other when we're writing or journaling or whatever. She wrote to Mother de Chateau, who was superior in Grenoble, not far from Annecy. She loved Annecy, Mother de Bréchard, and always felt in exile from Annecy. So she writes to Mother Père et Marie de Chateau, "You are beloved, cherished, caressed, and charitably supported in all necessities that may arise. You are at the door of a great and secure refuge, Annecy. Our blessed Annecy," she calls it. "Your pill is so well gilt and sugared. We have nothing here, and have been more sad, more poor, more desolate than you can imagine. I am weary of the burden of this office. Pray to God for me, my very dear sister, that he would relieve me of the burden, or give me the qualities required for bearing it. It does me so much good to pour my heart out to you, to unburden myself to you." Now, just as her zeal and that touch of hardness was moderated and tempered by abandonment to God's will, her virtue, contrast what I've just read to you by another letter she wrote to Mother de Chateau, who was herself feeling down, as we would say. She writes to Mother de Chateau, "To answer your dear and cordial letter, I wish to speak heart to heart." It's so important for us, for our order, heart to heart. For us as individuals, heart to heart. "I see with great compassion you bear your cross with some little difficulty. My dear and beloved friend, permit me to say that you are wrong not to accommodate yourself to this necessity, leadership. I have been in the same distress, as you know, but I clearly saw that the burden was of itself heavy enough, without increasing it by annoyance and weariness, which adds so much to its weight. Do not let the little courage, cheerfulness, tranquility we have be eaten up by discouragement. It is not enough to be resigned. We have the honor of being daughters of the great master of holy indifference. I mean him who described it so well to Theotonus. It's such a long letter, but it illustrates so well her conversion." And that's what I really want us to discover. Their moments of conversion. She converted from a woman of timidity, diffidence, feeling unloved, to a woman who could trust herself to others, let alone God. She had come to accept the reality of the present moment and caused Mother de Chateau in Grenoble to do the same. Charlotte de Bréchard was a serious character. I couldn't detect much levity in her at all. And I needed it, my goodness, when I was reading about her. I felt a little bit down, you know. Yet in the letter, she playfully says, "Thus we are called superiors, and are the subjects of as many minds as we govern. Just as a ship is called Victory and has no trophy, and another called Sun and has no light. She was still in Mulan when she wrote that and had yet to face... Come on, work. She had yet to face the realm, another painful foundation, but with greater strength and wholeness. I was so pleased to discover that Mère de Shoji, later on, when I was reading a letter, said she had a gentle gravity. Mother de Bréchard had a gentle gravity. As you have discovered, or you will discover, she was hard on herself, and even Holy Mother says in letters, oh no, please don't do that. Please don't engage in fasting. You know what it does to you. You have to keep well for the sake of the community. As she grew, she became more composed, more self-assured, more trusting, and as I said, she was able to let herself be loved and love others. Holy Mother's advice to young superiors to win the hearts of the sisters, she unerringly followed. We read that she neither controlled or interfered with the sisters in their offices, but said that the charitable sweetness of the spirit would have each one follow their own spirit. It's a great gamble, but we have to do it. She esteemed the mutuality of union of hearts as paramount in community living. Gosh, that's so true. The mutuality, it's a beautiful word. We just can't say it, we really have to live it. As we say in England, maybe you do, you put your money where your mouth is. You really have to know that. She died from a fever about 1637. And 8 years after her death, her monastery moved and they exhumed the graves. And it's documented in the departmental archives that her body was incorrupt and exhaled a perfume. Her cause for canonization was really, really strong. And it extended into the early part of the 20th century. And that's 1924. Mm-hmm. And that's a group at Riom praying that her beatification would take place. So it was a very, very strong, strong movement. We come to a very different person now. Mother Perrin Marie de Chaton. She was ardent, artistic, and articulate. She was the sort of person who walked into a room loving everyone and unconsciously expecting everyone to love her. We all know that sort of person. Like Mother Jacqueline, Marie Jacqueline, but so unlike Mother de Bréchard, her life was charmed. She was of Savoy, the youngest of 6 children, and was gifted by nature. She was everyone's favorite, including her mother's. Now, Mother de Shoji is very useful, but you know, she's a bit too much at times. And she has Perrin Marie de Chateau lying in her crib at about 8 months old with her hands joined. Yes. Really hard going. It's really hard going. So, you know, take it with a pinch of salt. She was rich, attractive, and had, a beautiful singing voice and could dance well. They were qualities that defined social etiquette in France in those days. I suppose in most of our countries. She wrote poetry and loved to talk. Her parents were very pious. And her upbringing was devotional. She had a great devotion to Our Lady from her early years. In fact, devotion to Our Lady was eminent at every stage of her life. Sometime before her 16th birthday, and I find this so interesting, she heard a sermon stating that God can be offended by thought as well as act. And this hadn't dawned on her before. So from that time onwards, she resolved to consciously think, in as far as she was able, on the good. Something akin to St. Paul's lovely words, fill your hearts with everything that is true, everything that is noble, everything that is good and pure, everything that we love and honor. I really felt when I read that it was a conscious decision that really did help her as she proceeded through life. Soon after that, she began to think of her elder sister entered the Poor Clare Convent, and she began to think a little of religious life, but it was only a reflection, not a resolve. She was much immersed in society and its delights, its attractions. She loved novels, especially romantic novels, music, literature. All these had a far more pressing claim on her than the thought of religious vocation. However, at the suggestion of her older sister, she found a spiritual director, and he gave her a simple rule of life, which again, for women, girls and women of her class, would have been kind of the thing to do. When she was 20, she went to Germany as a companion to a relative. The intention was to stay for about 6 months, but it extended to 18 months. She had no fluency in German and had to forsake meaningful conversation, the Peron, big deal. And to read, there wasn't much reading material around. So in Germany, because of the barrenness of her intellectual environment, the idea of religious resolve began to take more shape. And she began reading Louis of Granada. I'm trying to say St. Louis all the time. So she began reading Louis of Granada. However, an unforeseen event added to her confusion. I think she fell in love. But you know, you may not all agree with me. And the equerry who sought her wrote her poetry. Some she destroyed, but some she kept. She was perplexed, and the annals say, she said, it was impossible to carry a burning coal in one's breast without being set on fire. She was in love. And she tried to distract herself by service to the poor, again, a mark of women of her class. She began to pray more. I think of the two loves, God and the equerry. God had the greater claim, but she needed clarification and direction. Her director at home was a Jesuit, so it's probable and evident to me that she embarked on this discernment of spirits, how she felt towards God and the young equerry. So I think she kind of came to the decision that she found more peace in looking at her religious vocation rather than looking at the human love aspect of her life then. She seemed to resolve the predicament, but she continued bargaining with God, always loquacious, and searched for a sign to know the way forward vis-a-vis the religious vocation. So before returning to Savoy, she went on pilgrimage to the Church of Our Lady of Einsiedeln, a Swiss shrine, rather like the Italian Our Lady of Loreto. Her heart was now set on entering somewhere, rather like Sister Mary Paula in that book. When I was reading Sister Mary Paula's biography, I thought of Père Marie de Châtel very much. Thank you for making it concrete in today's world. So she went into this church, the Shrine of Our Lady. Remember, she had a great devotion to Our Lady. She had a diamond ring on her finger that her mother had given her. And she asked Our Lady to witness. She was putting it in the alms box. And she had this great simplicity, and she said, show me within a year where I should go. And this is another penchant of mine. I love words. And in French, sans without pleats, I like to think that our word simplicity comes from this. Without folds, you know, I'm full of pleats. I kind of think the word simplicity means nothing polluted, complicated. It is as it is. She bargained with Our Lady, she bargained with God, and indeed in the annals she is known for her simplicity, and Holy Founder loved her because of her simplicity. She was candid and transparent. And Holy Mother tells us that Holy Founder had a great esteem for her above all because of her perfect simplicity and candor that was dove-like. So she offered the ring as a token of her betrothal, and again, according to Medeshoji, she said, "I entreat you not to keep me languishing, but let it be a year at the latest before I know where I may enter." Then she returned home thinking, "Oh, I can't arrive quick enough for them. They'll be delighted to see me." Always loving and always loving. That security must be something else. We have moments of it. She seemed to be always living in it. She was very demonstrative. I love that sort of person too. Her family were very supportive of her decision to embrace religion. Oh, that's Holy Mother. I think I can use her again. Be patient. So she went back, and they helped her by not. She'd made her decision. And if you announced it in those days, you were impressed into society. From going to dances, and your embellishments you gave to your nieces and, not nephews, your nieces and your female relatives. And she did this, but not without repugnance. Quote, not without regret, I think, for her. And there was still the dilemma of where she was going to enter. The poor class was the natural avenue they thought she'd go down. But by providence, or by chance or by providence, she went with Annecy to a friend. And as she was entering the bishop's house, voila, Holy Mother was leaving. Holy Mother was leaving. And she was very struck by her demeanor, by her carriage, etc. And she went into Holy Founder and told him this. She said, "I'd like to attach myself to this woman. There's something about her." And he said to her, "If you wish, my daughter, we will most willingly receive you into our dear little congregation." And she did. She couldn't enter with the first three. She entered on the Feast of St. Anne, July the 26th, because an ulcer on her leg prevented her going at that time. 11 months after her bargaining with Our Lady at the shrine of Insulgel. Okay. She loved to write. She loved to write. We would say today she was an ardent journaler. As soon as she entered, she began a book of resolutions. And one of these was always to keep her mind centered on good things, reflecting back to what I said earlier. She began religious life with God as the staff on which I lean and Our Lady as my guiding star. Isn't that beautiful? She thought in metaphor and symbol. And the image that accompanied her all through life was of the spouse in the Canticle of Canticles. One of her favorite aspirations was from the Canticle, "I have found him whom my soul loves." After the Gospels, this was her favorite book, and Holy Founder called her the spouse of the Canticle, as though she perfectly imaged the longing and ardor of seeking and finding the beloved. She was mystical in temperament and romantic. As she journeyed, we are told, like the spouse, she asked the hills, the rivulets, the valleys, the hills for news of the beloved. The Canticle pervades her life like a perfume. In 1615, she went to Lyon with Holy Mother and was proc there for a little time. She went with Holy Mother to Grenoble and was left as superior. That's the interior of St. Marie Donneau. And when she was leaving, Holy Mother gave her the introduction, said, "This is all you need. This is all you need for your community and to make people, introduce people to Holy Founder." Now, I go back to St. Marie Donneau because this is the exterior, and there's a lovely story that I had 10 days ago. It's our monastery of Grenoble, and on the 19th of March, I think last year, the community of Voron, which is about 8 miles from Grenoble,
20 miles
from Grenoble, went there for the day to live as a community, because it was at the revolution, they had our sisters fled from there. They lived the life for the day there, and the bishop came in the evening as for compline, and there was a young woman there who was passing by and dropped in, and she's entering in Voron in August. Lovely story. But of course, for you, this is very, and for me, this is very important. It's where Philippine Duchesne lived. She entered in 1898, and of course, at the revolution, they fled. She went back to her home.
17.
And she tried in 1804, after the Reign of Terror, to regroup the sisters, but it didn't work, so she came to America. So it's rather nice for you, a great educationist, Sacred Heart sister. That's an example of Perron's writing. She's writing there to Holy Mother, giving Holy Mother advice, telling her to be brave and strong and to keep a firm view of God. There was an analysis done of Perron's writing some years ago. Perron Murray in Tibet, Virgin St. Paul, sent us the report. And the report said that she was, as a person, they said she was active, dramatic, enthusiastic, and driven by strong feelings and intuitions. That she responded instinctively, was often impulsive to a situation she encountered or created. I think her enthusiasm and energy would have energized any community. But there's often a reference to her lassitude in the annals. That could have been a physical thing or a bit of depression, I don't know. She left a wealth of written material, Sir Merdeshaw, she tells us, because of her propensity, her love for writing and journaling. And I would just like to say that one of the things she wrote was, "I will endeavor to treat my sisters with sweetness, familiarity, and holy confidence. I will make it known that I am entirely devoted to their service. On all occasions, I will have a great respect for those words given to Moses, 'Carry this people not only on your shoulders like a shepherd, but also shelter them in your heart.'" She had been superior in Grenoble and many other places. At 95, her mother, when she was superior in Chambéry, her mother asked to enter at 95, so she could die a visitandine. And I read this when my mother was visiting recently at 88. Mother de Châtel refused, and Holy Mother said, would you not do this for your own, what you do for strangers? So her mother did enter and died at 97 in the monastery of Chambéry in the habit. So she ended her life by honoring Our Lady. She had said in her early life that she awoke each morning and felt her heart turn towards that morning star, Mary. As she lay dying before the last stroke that robbed her of her speech, she was a great conversationalist. She said the Holy Virgin was a star of the sea, and that she had the sweet hope that she would cause a favorable wind to arise and carry her happily into port. She was the only one of the first mothers at whose bedside Jeanne de Chantal stayed, and she gave her permission to go. She said, "Go then," Holy Mother said, "go then, my dear daughter. Go in peace into the arms of our Lord who calls you, and carry our hearts to heaven." I'm skipping. Holy Mother said she was the portrait of all the virtues that the little community desired to cultivate. It's interesting, she was the only one to whom Holy Mother gave permission to go. That's lovely. You know, Mary Grace took up a little of my time, so I feel I've got a bit of liberty here. This was a very enigmatic character, and she gives me heart, because she didn't have an easy temperament. Holy Mother wrote of Claude Agnes de la Roche, "Our institute owes her an eternal gratitude for having so carefully collected the conferences of our holy venerable father and a great number of his sermons. God endowed her with so great a memory that she repeated word for word what our good prelate had preached. And Dom Mackie, the English Benedictine, who translated, said we owe her so much." She translated at least, she wrote down at least half of the conferences and many of the sermons. So we owe her a great deal. When she was leaving to make the foundation Orléans in 1620, Holy Founder gave into her hand the Conference on Hope. So whenever you're reading that, think of Claude Agnès Joly de la Roche. In 1620, he gave the conference into her hand on hope. She was born in the Chateau of Annecy, to the right, that dominated the town. That's the old town of Annecy. Her father was governor of Annecy. She was beautiful, lively, full of talent and grace, and much sought after in society. She was engaged, but decided she liked her fiancé, but didn't love him, so she broke it off. There were others waiting in the wings. She was from the same place as Jacqueline, Favre, and Savoy, and she used to watch Jacqueline in church praying before she entered, and she used to mimic her, mock her. And Medeshoji says, she laughed and imitated her in play, mocking her. But while she shut her eyes in joke, God opened her heart and gave her a religious vocation too. Now, I find her family really interesting. And for me, understanding the little glimpse you have of her family helped me to understand her. They were very zealously religious, and Holy Founder was their spiritual director. And there's the inference, only the inference, that he felt the need to moderate their piety. That's interesting. It's as though they were careless of their family affairs in order to pray and be pious, etc. Whereas, as we know, to lead the devout life doesn't neglect the state of life we're in. But it helped me to understand where Claude Agnès was coming from, and also that when she was young, her parents had such regard for her talents that they left her free. They never exercised any restraint. And it says she lived in great liberty all the time she was in their house, so that eventually she found submission a great trial. Everything about her was ardent and, again, dramatic. Even the fact she entered on the Feast of the Conversion of St. Paul, an ordinary ferrier day for her wouldn't have been the right day. It had to be on the day of the Conversion of St. Paul. She immediately set to work to overcome her rebellious temperament, and it was recognized that she did indeed have a quickness of disposition, as Mary Shoji charitably says. She strove above all to acquire humility, and again, it's the virtue that we remember on her memorial day. Her litany says, "You who are a model of humility, you who subdued your own will, etc." She wanted to be perfect, and she cried copiously when she failed. Mother de Chaux, she says, in charity, she cried because of her failings. Holy Mother says she cried because of self-love. She was again penitential and hard on herself. And when Holy Mother went to Bourg-en-Bresse to found, she left her in Annecy as an assistant, but her extraordinary fervor led her to excesses of zeal. She undertook great penances, which damaged her health. She died young. And it's interesting that she told she did this without the advice of Holy Mother or Holy Founder, the inference being, had they been available, it would have been tempered. Boundaries were not her thing. She was later consumptive, died of TB, and was the first pillar of the visitation to die. There are two women in the earlier annals of our institute of whom the word imperious is used. Mère de Chaux says in the life of Jeanne de Chantal, "Our Blessed Father said that she, Holy Mother, had a great courage and a nature imperious with more than a tendency to imperiosity." Quite something that, you know. In 1628, Claude Agnes had finished her mandate in Orléans, which had been founded, and was preparing to found Rennes. Mother Letellier was the new superior in Orléans, and Claude Agnes had written to Holy Mother, not, it seemed, in praise of the new superior, Mother Letellier, because Holy Mother replies to her, "I recognize in your letter a spirit too ardent and severe towards the superior. You lack respect and submission due to God in her person. You do it under the pretext of zeal, but it is a false God coming from a natural spirit which is imperious, with little compassion and not very patient." Now, I've really searched for the word imperious to be ascribed to others. It's only inscribed to two people, Holy Mother and Agnes Jolie de la Roche. And it's Holy Mother who calls her imperious. Whatever was in the letter that Mother Claude Agnes wrote would have arisen from her zeal for the rule, for what she deemed to be faithful observance. Her fundamental maxims for leadership were sweet charity, exact observance, and profound humility. I don't know anything about Mother Letellier, but I suspect as a new superior she was finding her way, making mistakes. Claude Agnes needed perfection and exact observance, and this need begot a certain imperiousness that possibly conveyed an arrogance. She needed to temper justice with compassion, as Holy Mother pointed out. The other explanation is she was scrupulous. Remember, her parents were pious, devout, maybe to the detriment of family life. But I think Mother Claude Agnes was scrupulous. That's a personal impression. We have very few letters that were written to her, and why? Any guesses? Like Holy Mother, she burnt them. There's real points of contingency between the two. She burnt letters, but she did inscribe in notebooks parts of letters, and one of these notebooks, I think, is in Paris. And in one of the letters, it's a letter from Holy Founder, and she entitled it Spiritual Counsels Given to Me by Monseigneur Holy Founder. She'd obviously unburdened herself to him, and he was counseling her to great peace, tranquility, sweetness, and gentleness, and not to dwell on her faults. He says she deceives herself in thinking she must make violent efforts, and goes on. This is really quite something, this letter. This applies also to your feelings of envy and jealousy and your liking for material comfort. Free your soul from every care except that of holding it in peace and tranquility. Your desire to be perfect is harmful. This will be especially difficult for you, as you have a lively nature that is interested and intrigued by all it meets. This need not discourage you. Take great care to rid yourself of your own will, for it is self-will that can harm you, and you have it very strongly. And what you want badly. Keep your spirit in peace, occupied with high things, away from self-preoccupation. And since you have a particular need of gentleness and humility, take great care during the day often to put your heart in humble sweetness. Strive to be even-tempered without allowing your moods to show. End of quote. This unevenness of exterior behavior, is detrimental to the full utilizing of your talents. Well, if he told her that she was moody, and moody enough to speak of it in that tone, she must have been fitful and erratic in temperament. She seemed to strive on drama. When she was asked to go to Rennes in Brittany, in northern France, she said to Holy Mother, "You have sent your poor Agnes to the ends of the world." So this coupled with a strong will and I think more than a little scrupulosity made her a not too easy disposition to live with or for herself. Her language, her love language was deeds of kindness, service. She was not at all demonstrative, either in her approach to others and in wanting others to be demonstrative to her. The other first mothers were very demonstrative, I think. She founded Orléans, and despite not having any secular founders, left it well provided for. If we compare the letters sent to her from Holy Founder, for example, in a 24-hour window, he wrote to Jacqueline Favre and he wrote to Claude Agnès. To Jacqueline, To Claude Agnès, he says, I greet dearly your heart and those of all our sisters, and I'm altogether more and more yours, my very dear daughter. Quite restrained and disciplined and contained, because she was contained, undemonstrative. To Jacqueline Favre, on the same day he wrote, a thousand blessings on your beloved heart, my very dear daughter. I am totally your very loving and unchangeable father. Just different, he knew how to address different people. Different people invited different things. And she was quite a scholar, I think, Claude Agnès. I think she was very bright. She did a study of St. Matthew's Gospel, sent it to Holy Mother, and then panicked that Holy Mother would keep it for posterity and, you know, her name would be enhanced. She needed to keep herself humble because she was imperious. And she then wrote to Holy Mother and said, "Oh, you know, destroy it. You've read it now, destroy it." Scrupulous to the nth degree. She was a woman of sentiment, but feared sentimentality. And just as she destroyed letters, she seemed to live without many necessities, let alone superfluities. And as I said, she died of TB at 38 in the year 1630. The thing was, at her death, before and after her death, she was renowned for her holiness. I think she had charm. I think she was very charming and had, you know, had a great command of language and was very... She wasn't demonstrative, but she seemed to be able to speak to people well. She's the only first mother whose remains aren't in Annecy. I think all the other first mothers are, but she was in Rennes when she died. So at the revolution, stuff went, things went missing. I think she and...
Would you mind if the sisters went and got coffee or a snack, just as you keep talking?
Okay.
Fine. No.
Yeah, okay. Go and have coffee if you want. But I just say that I think she and Holy Mother were very alike in temperament. I think they clashed. I think they were very cordial. But I think there was a little something of personality there. But Mother Claude Agnes was a work in progress. She died at 38, whereas Holy Mother outlived her by many years. She had the more direct influence of Holy Founder to be tempered, to be guided. She wasn't, like most of us, she wasn't perfect. She had a difficult temperament. I just like to think she was a work in progress that, you know, desired with all her heart to love God and to love others. They retained their individuality, both of them, and they had respect. And all I can say about her is she was a work in progress, but we owe her an eternal gratitude because she wrote down the conferences and the sermons. She's really, if you're a psychologist, she'd be a very good first mother to study, I think. And she gives us heart. She encouraged etymologically is to give new heart to each other. She really gives me heart. Do you want to break there? Because there's only one more mother to look at, and that won't be too long. I promise you, another 5 minutes or so. If you want to grab a coffee, fine. Spring water from Evian. It's bottled and sent, so it's renowned for its spring water, maybe here too. And I put a ring around this. It's the monastery of St. Catherine, which I thought that's where she was educated, and I discovered later she wasn't educated there. She was educated in Annecy, but I didn't bother taking the ring off. And that's geographically where it is, just north of Annecy on the lake.
They make the water. Mm-hmm. And maybe make
it was in the Chablais at that time, Evian, and Holy Founder was a great friend of Monsieur de Blenay and often stayed with the family when he was in the Chablais. He knew Marie Aimée as a young child, and Elizabeth Stopp writes that he knew her when, as a young child, and remembers her in a large straw hat in her life. When she was elected Superior of Lyon in 1622, Holy Founder wrote to her, and I quote, "I may in truth call you my very dear daughter, for you have been dear to me from your mother's womb, or at least from her breast, while I have 100 times blessed you. I was so graciously received in your home, and it gives me great pleasure to talk to you about those early years." So he knew her as she was growing up, because he stayed with the family. He called her La Cadette, as I said, in an affectionate way of referring to her as the youngest child. Whenever he wrote to her, he did so very warmly and very affectionately, and often mentioned her family. And it was a lovely touch, because when she was leaving Annecy in 1615, he wrote to his friend, her father, Monsieur de Blenay, and said he didn't have any, her father, her blood father, didn't have any right or authority, but as she was going to Lyon, to France, on the first foundation, would he give her his blessing? It's a lovely little courteous cordial touch. He called her father his brother, her father his brother and friend. After her mother's death, her father became a priest and retired excuse me, and retired back to his chateau to live a life of devotion. He had hoped that Marie Amy, the youngest child, would be with him in his latter years to, you know, keep an eye to him. So he was a bit disappointed when she said she was going to enter, but didn't oppose it, but a little disappointed. And as I said, she was very well educated at the Abbey of St. Catherine near Annecy. She entered at the same time as Claude Agnès, but as you can see, outlived her first companions by many years, and the others by 12, the Holy Mother by 8. Now, this is, again, a personal response, if I may say. Before entering the visitation, she'd often meditated on chapter 4 of St. Matthew's Gospel. She'd often meditated on chapter 4 of St. Matthew's Gospel, but finished with the call of the first disciples. Holy Founder took it further and said to her just a few days after she entered in 1612, "My dear daughter, until this moment you have meditated on the fourth chapter. You must now apply yourself to the following three chapters, because I principally drew from them the spirit and maxims I will establish in my congregation." I think it's a little surprising that not more has been made of that within the Visitation and the Salesian world generally. I know the Sermon on the Mount is the charter for Christian spirituality, and a blueprint for us all, but here we have Holy Founder specifically stating that he principally took it as the basis for our spirituality. She went with Holy Mother and Mother Favre to Lyon and served there initially as novice mistress and then in 1620 as superior. Archbishop de Marcomont, that I have to say, in rereading, I have warmed to tremendously. I always held him in great suspicion until the last couple of weeks. He wrote about Marie Amy. He said, "As to Sister Marie Amy de Blonay, I have remarked two excellent and rare qualities. She knows how to speak with great wisdom and to be silent as if she had no words. She is truly fit for a foundation. She will not build upon the moving sands of appearances, but upon the living stone of our Lord Jesus Christ." This was so true because she was integral to so many foundations, either personally or sending sisters or financially. And I think I've got a picture of all the places she founded. Having read Mother Marie Amy's life and some of her letters, I have the impression of a very rounded personality and a very creative thinker. Not only was she an ideas person, she was a catalyst. As the Visitation moved through the decades following Holy Founder's death, 20s, 30s, and the decade almost following the death of Holy Mother, she was superior at Lyon at the time of Holy Founder's death, when they had spent a lot of time discussing the structures, this is really important, the structures that would facilitate the order's growth. The last thing he said to her on the 27th of December, 1621, before going back to his gardener's cottage, that's the site of the gardener's cottage, and the plaque above says, in 1622, that was the site of the gardener's cottage where he died. It's easy to read. The last thing he said to her was, "Adieu, my daughter. I give you my heart and my spirit." And you will recognize that as one of our legacies that we take in December. Her long conversations with him over the Christmas period of 1621, regarding a superior general for the order or a visitor general by the Holy See, gave her the courage and the confidence to deal with this after Holy Mother's death. Of course, soon after, he said to her, "I give you my heart." His heart was enshrined in the monastery of Leon. That's now Peace Station in Leon, but it's our first regular monastery. It was there till the revolution and went to Treviso. And you will recall Sister Perrin Marie Tiber's lovely study and translation she did in 1999 about the legacy called Spirit and Heart, the Legacy. One of the first indications of her tenacity to uphold the liberty of the order in a world clerically dominant came in the middle of 1620s in her dealings with Archbishop Miron, who succeeded Archbishop de Maucomont in Lyon. We are told he had a magisterial gravity. He established a group of advisors to help him to understand the diocese, and particularly the religious. Belcourt had just been built, and he wanted to examine the account books, the receipts, all of the business that goes with that. He sent one of his priests, who insisted on removing them from the monastery, to examine them. Marie Amy left the room, came back with all the books, all the annals, and said very sweetly, "Please tell the Archbishop," quote, "he could see them for as long as he pleased, whenever he would favour the community with a visit, but that she would not allow, I could not allow them in any other manner to be seen without offending against the Institute, which forbids them being taken out of enclosure."
Love it.
The priest went away, and later the books were eventually examined in the parlour. Now, there's a few interventions that are really interesting. So the other intervention was he assigned a priest of his own choice. Remember, it was a very clerically dominant world. This new archbishop assigned a priest of his own choice to act as chaplain. He assigned him. Mother Dublonie convened the chapter and then asked the archbishop to understand that while the visitation houses were subject to bishops in whose diocese they resided, they were, according to Holy Founder, at liberty to choose whom they wanted for chaplain, after which the bishop could approve. She was such a brave woman. She was threatened with deposition, but maintained her equilibrium and calm. Her biographer says she spoke up with fortitude, not only for the liberty of the sisters specifically, and her order generally, but also that justice be done to the then present chaplain who'd served them so faithfully. The archbishop eventually left them at liberty to live according to their customs and constitutions. Now, this next intervention is really important for us. And it's a situation that arose after Holy Mother's death. And it would have had great repercussions for us had it been let go. There was a movement to change the character of the visitation in two ways: to appoint a visitor general with proper jurisdiction over all the monasteries, and to change the common chant to Gregorian. She was superior in Annecy at the time, and the last of the first generation of mothers. She was much respected and looked to as personifying the vibrancy of our Holy Founder's vision. Drawing on the extensive conversations with Holy Founder over that Christmas period of 1621-1622, just prior to his death, and to her discussions with Holy Mother, she felt both points were contrary to the spirit bequeathed to us. She understood from them both that each monastery should be autonomous after its canonical erection, that it be fully inserted in the diocese of the local church, and subject to Annecy, subject to the bishop, that Annecy have a primacy as la censors and be looked to in any matter relating to custom and constitution that communities felt they could not resolve. However, she did not rely on her own musings, her own deliberations, her own judgment. She wrote to each house of the Institute, 87 of them, in days when we didn't have email or post or easy communication. She sent copies of the proposals, asking the sisters to pray, discuss among themselves, and consult their local bishops how she should respond. This kind of collegial endeavor is impressive, especially as I say when communication is so difficult. Universally, the sisters agreed with Mani Imi. Bishops wrote back saying to her they would never receive a visitor with a mandate with real authority and continue the protection of the order that the Blessed Founder had confided to them. Having taken this advice, she wrote, quote, "If we had done this, we submit ourselves to another yoke and take means for our perfection other than those our Blessed Father appointed us, and would perish just as we were coming to birth." With regard to the Gregorian chant, she withstood that argument too. She felt it wasn't in keeping with the simplicity of the visitation. It demanded a lot of practice, and in those days, it became a performance. Mm-hmm. So that was dismissed too. She had been elected superior in Annecy in 1641, just prior. Holy Mother had been deposed. She was elected. She was brought from Bourg. And at the end of that year, Holy Mother died at Moulins. She received Holy Mother's body back to Annecy and determined that the sorrow and loss that she and the community felt should be channeled into thanksgiving for her life and a zeal for honoring her memory. The loss of Holy Founder had driven her to print the conferences and letters and to construct the first regular monastery, to make a second foundation in Lyon. The loss of Holy Mother energized her further, always an ideas person. She rebuilt the first church of Annecy. I'm out of sync again. She rebuilt that church that some of us had the privilege of seeing and praying in, and that housed the tombs of Holy Founders until the Revolution. And she started the process of the beatification of Holy Founder that Mère de Chergy finished. She died the 15th of June, 1649, with Mère de Chergy, her novice, and Charles Auguste de Sales with her. Her reputation for wisdom, sound judgment, and holiness was acclaimed all through her lifetime, and with her death, the visitation entered a new era. It was the end of the beginning. Any time that one reads about Mother de Blonay, Holy Founder's description of her as the cream of the visitation is her writing, is cited. My impression of her is of a measured personality. She was ardent, but not as intense as Charlotte de Bréchard, nor as Perrin Mallet was in yet another sense. She had an excellent mind, like Mère de Favre and Claude Agnès, but not as introspective as Jacqueline Favre, and unlike Claude Agnès, worked within boundaries. She married insight to zeal, and these carried through to accomplishment. She didn't calculate her way through life, but neither did she daydream. Otherwise, you might be in a different position today with our visitor general. As one reads her biography and letters, there's a sense in which head and heart were always at play and ready to receive from the other. She was finished, rounded, contained. And so, these are the first five mothers, the foundation stones of our institute, as Charles Augustus Bessels call them. The significance of our history, our shared history, is important in the understanding of ourselves as individuals and as persons living in community who live Jesus today. However, we do them a disservice only by honoring their memory. It is appropriate to celebrate their lives and achievements, not only by knowing about them and recalling their time in history. It's also important to let their moment in history, the springtime of our order, to reverberate in our lives. They are like ripples in the waters of our shared consciousness that causes waves of hope and confidence in the now and in the future. They gave heart to Glycera's bouquet through their diverse temperaments, via the colors of their personalities, by means of the light and the shadow of their unique gifts and personalities. They were women of the early part of the 17th century, and we have to let them speak to us today. God be praised.
For more information about the Order of the Visitation of Holy Mary, go to visitationspirit.org.